A widow smells her husband's scarf and crumbles. A father sits frozen in his daughter's empty bedroom. A woman discovers her brother's suicide note, and her world splits in two. Grief doesn't knock politely. It kicks down the door and rearranges everything we thought we knew about living. Julia Samuel, who has spent 3 decades sitting with the bereaved as a grief psychotherapist, understands something most of us resist. Grief isn't a problem to solve, but a paradox to inhabit. We must somehow accept what we fundamentally refuse to believe, live in a world we never wanted, and carry on when every cell in our body wants to stop. This isn't weakness. It's the most human thing we do. Grief and mourning aren't the same thing, though we use the words interchangeably. Grief is the internal earthquake, the raw emotional response to loss. Mourning is the slow, painful reconstruction, adjusting to a world where someone essential no longer exists. When someone we love dies, our protective illusions shatter. We spend our lives maintaining a comfortable distance from our own mortality, but death tears that veil away. Suddenly, we're forced to confront the truth we've been avoiding. We too will die. Everyone we love will die, and we control far less than we pretend. This existential confrontation explains why grief feels like drowning. It's not just about missing someone, but about facing the terrifying fragility of existence itself. Grief operates like an iceberg. What others see, our composed face at the funeral, our return to work, represents only a fraction of what's happening beneath. We oscillate constantly between confronting loss and escaping it. We cry over old photographs, then numb ourselves with television. We talk to the dead person as if they're still here, then throw ourselves into work to forget they're gone. This isn't inconsistency, it's survival. We can only face grief in doses before needing to retreat. What damages us isn't grief itself, but our attempts to avoid feeling it. Some people drink themselves numb. Others work 80-hour weeks. Some shut down emotionally, becoming ghosts in their own lives. These strategies provide temporary relief, but compound suffering over time. The cruel paradox: the only way through grief is to feel it fully, take breaks through healthy distraction, then return to feeling it again. Slowly, painfully, we adapt to a reality we never wanted. British attitudes toward death have transformed dramatically. Victorians embraced elaborate mourning rituals, with Queen Victoria modeling lifelong grief. World wars changed everything. With 700,000 UK military deaths in WW1, followed by the devastating 1918 flu pandemic, public grief became psychologically impossible. As Christianity declined and medicine advanced, death became viewed as medical failure rather than God's will. The 21st century brings new openness. Terminal diagnoses are discussed more honestly. Palliative care emphasizes individual needs, and social media enables sharing the dying process. Caitlin's husband David drank himself to death after years of addiction. When he died, she felt something unspeakable: relief. His alcoholism had poisoned their family life, yet she loved him deeply. How do you grieve someone whose death brings both devastation and liberation? She swung between healthy coping and self-destruction, cooking nutritious meals one day, partying recklessly the next. 18 months later, she'd found her footing. She hadn't moved on from David, she'd learned to carry him differently. Kaylee's partner Mitchell died instantly in a cycling accident. He'd been her only boyfriend, her primary decision maker, the person who made her feel complete. Without him, she felt like half a person. She wore black constantly, drank heavily, couldn't sleep. Her grief spiraled into a suicide attempt. Intellectually, she knew Mitchell was dead. Emotionally, she felt abandoned. How could he leave her? Stephen's wife, Jenny, died suddenly in a car accident. He numbed himself with vodka and food while maintaining perfect composure at work. Their marriage had been complicated. Jenny had resented his slow commitment, withdrawn physically in their last decade together. After her death, he felt relief from her constant criticism. He also missed their family life terribly. Less than a year later, he began an online relationship that rekindled his capacity for intimacy. These stories reveal an uncomfortable truth. We can love someone deeply and still feel relief when they die. There's no right timeline for moving forward, no appropriate waiting period before dating again. Grief doesn't follow rules, and healing looks different for everyone. Brigitte's mother died suddenly, and she became a machine, immaculate appearance, excelling at work, caring for everyone. Inside, she was collapsing. She couldn't say no despite understanding boundaries intellectually. Her capacity for love felt depleted, causing her to lash out at her teenage daughter, Zelma. Work became both salvation and prison. Eventually, Brigitte made different choices, choosing activities that brought joy rather than filling time. She developed an inner core where her mother's love could live while she engaged with the world again. The grief didn't disappear, but she expanded her life around it. Max's mother died when he was young, making him the family's emotional fixer at the cost of his own identity. He spent decades in toxic relationships, always trying to save broken people. Through therapy, he recognized the pattern. Hurt takes me straight to that mom place. He researched his mother's life, collecting precious memories of her singing and carrying him on her back. Eventually, Max internalized her presence. "I've got hold of mom, and I've put her in me." He stopped seeking external validation and concluded, "I feel much more sort of valid as a human being. I'm all right, just as me." Cheryl presented a guarded version of herself until she brought her mother's scarf to a session. Smelling her mother's perfume triggered overwhelming emotion, reconnecting her to childhood memories of sitting in her mother's lap. This sensory experience unlocked her grief, allowing her to rediscover the mother who had loved her as best she could. Sometimes, grief needs a physical key, a smell, a song, a texture, to unlock what words can't reach. Family systems shake when someone dies. Closed families with poor communication struggle more than open families where trust allows honest discussion. For children grieving parents, understanding death's permanence develops gradually, typically reaching full comprehension around age 8. Some children show little initial reaction. Research indicates this is often delayed grief that may emerge up to 2 years later. Ruth came to therapy after her half-brother Daniel died in a car accident, but Daniel's death wasn't her deepest wound. Her father, a Holocaust survivor, had transmitted his trauma to her like an inheritance. She'd internalized his survivor's guilt, numbed herself to block inherited terror, disconnected from emotions to avoid his pain. Through therapy, she confronted this transmitted trauma. She sold her father's rental properties and met Daniel's mother to learn about her half-brother's life. She found compassion for both herself and her father. Not forgiveness exactly, but understanding. Mussie's brother Hashim shot himself after paranoid episodes likely triggered by drug use. Mussie entered therapy wearing designer clothes and masculine swagger, masking profound grief beneath materialism. His mother barely functioned with PTSD. His Muslim father consumed himself with shame and fury. Mussie described his internal state as a supernova of explosive emotions, guilt, rage, trauma, all colliding. Through therapy, he processed grief through powerful imagery and gradually found ways to remember Hashim without being consumed by pain. The grief didn't disappear, but she expanded her life around it. Suicide complicates grief in particular ways. The guilt feels like a physical wound. Unanswerable questions circle constantly. Why didn't I see the signs? What could I have done? The stigma creates extreme isolation. People don't know what to say, so they say nothing. One helpful reframe: suicide is a heart attack of the brain. The person wasn't functioning normally, which helps remove blame and shame. Fazia's sister, Aliyah, received a motor neurone disease diagnosis, beginning anticipatory grief, mourning someone still alive. Fazia struggled with guilt about living in the UK while Aliyah deteriorated in Pakistan, breaking cultural traditions of family duty. As Aliyah lost mobility, speech, and independence while remaining cognitively aware, Fazia's grief evolved from overwhelming floods of tears to persistent sadness. Eventually, she found peace. "I think of Aliyah every day. I see her face in my mind. I'm not afraid anymore that I will forget her. She is part of me." Henry and Mimi kept Aiden's clothes, bassinet, and breast pump, their only tangible connections to him. Memory is all we have, and memories from before are hard to let go of, Mimi explained. Their rental remained a ghost flat where they'd never made it their own. Eventually, they found courage to move forward. Mimi ordered beautiful containers for Aiden's things to embroider with his initials. They moved flats and got a puppy, a turning point toward hope and rebuilding trust in life. Phil and Annette's daughter Amber died, making simple questions agonizing. How many children do you have? Should they deny Amber's existence by saying two? Say three without mentioning death? Their son Henry, though appearing to accept Amber's death mechanistically, remained fiercely loyal, once furiously correcting someone who said there were only two children in the family. 9 months later, Annette became pregnant. This wasn't replacing Amber, but represented hope running parallel to grief. Research shows bereaved parents face a 70% higher risk of psychiatric hospitalization in the first year. Mothers tend to remain preoccupied longer, experiencing more anxiety and sleep disruption. Men often avoid discussing the death, feeling they must be strong, which leads to their grief being discounted. Common misconceptions include assuming a baby's death hurts less than an older child's. Pain relates to love invested, not age. While the whole representing loss doesn't diminish, bereaved parents can eventually expand their lives around it through accommodation. Jean, 48, received a fatal lung cancer diagnosis with 6 months to live. Her primary concern wasn't herself, but her 17-year-old son, James. She prepared birthday cards for him until age 21 and arranged for him to draw pictures while lying beside her. When told she had only days or weeks left, she admitted being frightened for the first time, yet still prioritized discussing James. Barbara's kidney cancer returned with a tumor the size of a tangerine, leaving her months to live. "I don't want to die," she admitted, tears breaking through her composed exterior. She hosted a birthday tea party that was clearly a farewell, though she couldn't quite admit it. Gordon, initially furious about his treatment, struggled with excruciating hip pain until bone cancer was confirmed. When morphine managed his pain, a profound shift occurred. He stopped fighting and accepted death, which brought him calm. He chose his coffin and headstone with a blue check pigeon on it and took communion for the first time since youth, making peace through his Catholic faith. The dying must balance hope for life with acceptance of death, facing both their own loss and the grief of those who love them. A good death comes when acceptance replaces fighting, one with grace, tenderness, and painlessness in a secure, loving environment. Yet some need to fight until the end. Our communication about dying fails. 48% die in hospital, though only 2% would choose to, and less and less third discuss their wishes with family. We should talk, plan, and prepare for death long before facing it. Grief doesn't end. It transforms. We don't get over significant losses. We learn to carry them differently. The pillars of strength form an integrated framework. Maintaining our relationship with the deceased through memory boxes and rituals, practicing deep self-compassion, accepting grief's own timeline, establishing regulating routines through exercise, healthy eating, and sleep, and leaning on friends and family who offer specific memories rather than empty platitudes. These stories offer no neat conclusions because real grief doesn't have them. Small signals mark turning points. Receding fear, emotional release, decisions to try again, finding powerful imagery for feelings. By doing the difficult psychological work of grieving, we build secure futures filled with potential. Though changed forever, we move forward with profound gratitude for having loved deeply. In a world that demands we move on, grief reminds us that some things cannot be overcome quickly. The depth of our grief reflects the depth of our love. To grieve fully is to honor what we've lost. To carry our dead with us, not as burdens, but as presences, is to remain fully human. Your grief is not a problem to fix, but a testament to your capacity for love. Feel it, endure it, and trust that you will find your way through, not by leaving your loved one behind, but by learning to carry them forward.